Consider, for example, the various petitions that may be found in Madrid's Archivo Histórico Nacional, it's the equivalent to the Public Record Office, or I should say the National Archives now, complaining bitterly of the swarms of priests, monks, friars, and clerks in minor orders that thronged the streets of city after city in the Patriot zone, and demanding that they be called up for the army forthwith in order to spare those who had a more useful contribution to make to society. Petitions, moreover, whose clumsy hand and eccentric spelling suggest that they are the authentic voice of the people. And let me just quote just one of these scrawled, anonymous complaints. Basically says, once you can decipher the incredible handwriting, not to mention the incredible spelling, it basically says, if the priests and the monks want a war, then let them go and fight and leave us in peace. Now, in Iraq, certainly, mullahs may have had much to do with the strength of resistance. But in Spain, religion was therefore almost certainly of only marginal importance. To say as much may be unexpected, shocking even. For there are certainly moments when devotion to Catholicism genuinely appears to have played a major role in stiffening Spanish resistance. But those moments can usually be explained by reference to very, very exceptional circumstances. They can't be taken as a guide to what happens in the country as a whole. In just the same way, the fact that there were very successful and very effective guerrillas doesn't mean that the whole guerrilla movement was successful and effective. Hard cases, as they say, make bad law. And the same goes for history. Now, what was important in Spain, however, was the presence of substantial regular armies. From the spring of 1809 onwards, the Anglo-Portuguese army of Lord Wellington, strictly speaking, he didn't acquire the title of Duke until 1814, was a constant presence in the western part of the peninsula. While the periphery of the country, from fairly early on in the conflict, the French always dominated Madrid and the area around it, was defended by a chain of Spanish armies stretching in a great crescent from Catalonia right up against the French frontier in the northeast, right down round the coast of the Mediterranean to Portugal, and then starting again from north of Portugal and stretching along the northern coast. Now, scarcely mentioned in any of the analyses that we have mentioned, these forces, Anglo-Portuguese on the one hand and Spanish on the other, were a vital factor in the survival of irregular resistance in the zone of French occupation. For they meant that the invaders could never simply concentrate on counterinsurgency operations. In truth, they were a dwindling resource. Between January 1810 and January 1812, in particular, the French inflicted fearsome damage on the Spanish armies and captured many of the fortresses on which they ultimately depended for their survival, whilst yet keeping Wellington firmly cooped up inside Portugal. But they were never eliminated. In part, of course, because so many French troops were constantly tied up in internal security operations. If it was only the Anglo-Portuguese army that retained the capacity to engage in large-scale offensive operations, this was enough. As witness the campaigns of 1812 and 1813, when Wellington's Anglo-Portuguese army, with some Spanish support, marches forth and drives the French from the peninsula. Now, the importance of the presence of these regular forces is revealed in still greater clarity by a consideration of the Calabrian Rebellion of 1806 to 1810. Calabria is the toe of the Italian boot. It's the long peninsula that stretches out towards Sicily. And a thoroughly poverty-stricken and unpleasant place it was in the Napoleonic period. Far less well known than the Spanish example, this resistance struggle conformed far more to type, in that it was entirely the work of bands of civilian irregulars operating in an area characterised by wild mountains covered with Mediterranean scrub. Under a variety of local chieftains, these men were able to cause considerable damage to the French forces who had occupied the region at the time of the overthrow of the Kingdom of Naples in 1806. But unlike their Spanish counterparts, they did not enjoy the support of a regular army, or at least not on any constant basis. At the same time, they failed to produce any leaders of the sort you see in Spain, leaders who were capable of taking mere armed peasants and turning them into real soldiers. And the result was that the revolt slid ever more deeply, ever more quickly into mere brigandage, banditry. Even then, suppressing it took much time and effort, not to mention the development of efficient counter-insurgency strategies. But suppressed it eventually was. The fact being, then, that guerrilla wars in the Napoleonic era were certainly not unwinnable. By now, it should be becoming clear that there are serious holes in the arguments of those who have held up the Peninsular War as proof positive of the folly of invading Iraq. But even now, the catalogue of problems is not exhausted. Thus, also absent from their analysis is the strategic context. Given the unique complexity of the struggle in Spain and Portugal, victory was always going to be a slow process, and in addition, one that required a great number of troops. Thus, to win the war, the French were going to have to conquer, if not every inch of the peninsula, then at least a very significant proportion of it. Although the commitment of the British, Spanish and Portuguese leadership to the struggle never cracked, it is at least possible that had a certain tipping point been reached, if you like, one or other partner in the alliance, could well have been the British government, could have pulled out. Never actually happened in the realms of counterfactual history. But it is at least notionally possible. Anyway, whether it was to achieve total victory or to reach some notional tipping point, obviously the French had to maintain a constant forward policy that would erode Allied military capacity and deprive the little war, if you want, of the bases and supply lines on which it ultimately depended. However, such a policy imposed heavy requirements on the French, and in particular, large numbers of men. Not only was it necessary to keep the field armies that actually carried the war to the enemy up to strength, but it was also necessary to back them up with sufficient troops to withstand the multiple threats that could be posed to the territory which they managed to occupy. And all this in a war zone in which losses from disease and privation were always likely to be extremely high. After a slow start, the forces sent to Spain and Portugal in 1808 were both too few in number and, broadly speaking, of very poor quality. From the end of 1808 until the middle of 1811, the necessary level of commitment was maintained, in that Napoleon poured a steady stream of replacements and reinforcements across the Pyrenees. The period, then, is one of repeated French victories, and one may even say that the French were winning the war. But then suddenly the strategic context altered dramatically. Thanks to the Emperor's decision to invade Russia, the tap, so to speak, was turned off, and the flow of fresh troops was suddenly checked. Being Napoleon, however, the French ruler could not tolerate the blow to his prestige that ordering a halt to offensive operations in Spain would have constituted, and he therefore insisted that his generals continue to press on with the attacks in which they were engaged, most notably against the eastern city of Valencia. With the French forces already at full stretch, the results were all too predictable. To support these operations in the east of Spain, large numbers of troops had to be pulled away from somewhere else. That somewhere else was the west of Spain. Napoleon said that'd be fine. The British wouldn't attack. They were all dying of disease, and the Portuguese were absolutely useless. So that was fine. Except it wasn't. His troops pulled away. Wellington immediately sees his opportunity and pounces. And that basically is when the whole house of cards in Spain starts to collapse. By the end of 1812, the French had, in fact, lost about half the territory which they started with at the start of the year. In much of the country, their presence had been reduced to a series of isolated garrisons that were powerless to help either themselves or one another. In short, there was no surge in Spain. Finally, there is the claim that the Peninsular War played a major role in bringing down the French Empire. Well, it is late, so I will simply deal with that in one line. It didn't. To conclude, then, it can be seen that attempts to make use of the Peninsular War as a means of denigrating the Anglo-American War in Iraq are on almost every level open to serious question. This is not to say that George Bush and Tony Blair cannot be criticised for launching the conflict, nor still less that many of the points made by the critics of the war that we have looked at do not make perfectly good sense insofar as they relate to the situation in Iraq. There is a perfectly good, sensible and logical case that can be made out against intervention in Iraq. That is not the issue. The issue is how you defend it. And by dragging in a completely inapposite historical parallel, which can be shot down in flames at literally every turn, is not the way to make the case. It has been an abuse of history.